Hello, and welcome to the History of the Early Church. Episode 17, Pagan Reactions. Before we begin, I want to thank everyone for their patience. As I'm sure some of you can probably guess, being a college student, late October and early November is a very busy time for me, with midterms scattered about and right now going into finals. So I appreciate all your patience, and with that said, let's get back into this. Last time, we looked at one of the most infamous persecutions of the early church, the pogrom of Lyons in 177 AD. In this episode, we will not only continue to see pagan persecution of Christians, but also the attacks made by pagan intellectuals against the church. As the second century was coming to a close, the elite thinkers of the pagan world began to take Christianity more seriously as a religious threat. In earlier decades, most people outside the church were generally poorly informed about the Christian religion. You may remember how Pliny the Younger was surprised to discover that Christians did not commit incest, adultery, or other similar crimes. And while charges like these still roused the hostility of the common people, such as in Lyons, the upper class of Roman society was beginning to be better informed about this new faith and why it was something they needed to oppose. We'll be examining some of these pagan critics and see just what they found objectionable about the followers of Jesus Christ. So far, I have tried to keep the narrative as chronological as possible, while still making sure every episode has some coherence of subject. But history is not neat like that. Multiple events in multiple places were happening simultaneously. As a result, like episode 15, this episode was difficult to assemble without losing all sense of narrative coherence. Thus, before we dive into the pagan reactions, there are a couple of things we need to cover first. First is the response to the Gallic pogrom by Justin Martyr's famous student, Tatian the Assyrian. While we cannot be sure, it does seem that the persecution in Lyons was what occasioned Tatian to write his Oration to the Greeks. Similar to his teacher, Justin's first apology was most likely occasioned by the martyrdom of Polycarp. At some point after Justin's own martyrdom in 165 AD, Tatian departed from the Catholic fold and became the leader of a heretical sect called the Encratites. The Encratites embraced rigorous and Gnostic doctrines, such as the rejection of marriage and the belief in aeons. A unique point of Tatian's theology was that he rejected the salvation of Adam. What stands out most, though, in terms of Tatian's beliefs, especially as they departed from the teachings of Justin, is his hostility towards the Greek world. Whereas Justin strived to find a way to bridge the gap between classical and Christian, Tatian ridiculed every aspect of Greek culture, philosophy, poetry, art, etc. For Tatian, the, quote, barbarian philosophy of Moses, the Hebrew prophets, and Jesus was far superior and far more moral than the so-called civilized philosophy of the Greeks. Perhaps, though, it is not too surprising Tatian went down a more rigorous road. He had been with Justin when the pagan critic Crescens had heaped abuses on them. He saw how his teacher had tried to reach the Greco-Roman world, only to have his head cut off. Tatian was an Assyrian, originating from the war-torn region between the Roman and Parthian empires. For Tatian, the Greeks were a smug, arrogant, and hypocritical civilization. From the vantage point of a non-Romanized provincial on the edge of the empire, Tatian could look upon the Greek world and see it for what he believed it truly was, a violent and immoral society built on philosophies inferior to Judeo-Christian monotheism. Before we move on, I should also note something on a different note of what Tatian did, in that he was the first writer to produce a harmony of the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, in what is called the Diatessaron. The Diatessaron would be very popular in the church in Syria, and would very quickly be translated from Greek to Syriac, Syriac being a dialect of Aramaic spoken around the city of Edessa. When we get to the end of the 3rd century and discuss the formation of the Christian Bible, we will return to Tatian's Diatessaron and see how it influenced the Syrian church. Moving on to another group of rigorists, we need to tie up the story of the early Montanus controversy. Right in the middle of the controversy, the pogrom in Gaul occurred, and so our focus was diverted there. Nonetheless, the Gallic martyrs were not isolated from the theological controversy, for, as we saw last time, they themselves submitted their own opinion concerning the new prophecy. So let us now return our attention to the heresy of Phrygia. We left off discussing how the response to Montanism in the Church of Rome was far more relaxed to that of the Asian churches. Bishop Eleutherius appears to have been urged by the Christians of Gaul to both reject and handle mildly the Montanist heresy. There is one more piece of evidence concerning Eleutherius' view towards the new prophecy. At some time in the late 2nd century, a bishop of Rome was initially favorably disposed towards Montanism, but was convinced otherwise by an Asian Christian named Praxius. However, it is unclear if the bishop of Rome referred to in our source is Eleutherius or his successor, Victor. Either way, while the Roman Church was not quite as forceful in its rejection of Montanism, they ultimately concurred with their Asian brethren. The person of Praxius will show up again later in our podcast, as he would become connected to the Christological heresies that would plague Rome in the early 3rd century. So what became of the Montanist movement? Eusebius's anonymous source against Montanism mentions that both Montanus himself and the prophetess Maximilla were driven to suicide, though he admits there are doubts concerning this story. The Montanists claim that the end would come before the death of the prophetess Priscilla, but alas, she died and the Roman Empire continued to exist in peace. The movement, however, would live on, reaching both Rome and Carthage near the end of the 2nd century. The last mention of Montanism that I am aware of is in the 6th century AD, where the movement either died out and or was suppressed by the then Orthodox Christian Roman state. Like the Judaizers, Gnostics, and Marcionites, Montanists will appear again infrequently as we progress through the centuries. Now we may finally discuss the pagan intellectuals of Antonine Rome who responded to the growing Christian church. It was not until the end of the 2nd century that Christianity was understood well by the elite of the Roman Empire. Critical mentions of Christianity appear in classical authors such as the Stoic moralist Epictetus, Pliny the Younger, the historians Tacitus and Suetonius, Apuleius, author of The Golden Ass, Marcus Cornelius Fronto, the great rhetorician, the satirist Lucian of Samosata, and of course, Emperor Marcus Aurelius himself. Among these, Pliny and Tacitus are the best informed. Pliny, because he had direct encounters with Christians, as we saw in episode 9. Tacitus correctly states how Christianity originated from Judea, from Christ, who was crucified under the governor Pontius Pilate. However, only a Pliny appears to have knowledge of the inner life of Christians, which, to his surprise, was not full of depravity and immorality. But for most of the 2nd century, the popular slurs against Christians as belonging to an immoral atheistic sect were believed even by the educated upper class. The great rhetorician and tutor of Marcus Aurelius, Fronto, delivered a speech in which he denounced Christians, claiming they drank heated blood and indulged in incestuous orgies. For what follows, I am largely dependent on Robert Louis Wilkins' excellent book, The Christians as the Romans Saw Them. I highly recommend it to anyone listening that wants to understand the pagan perspective towards early Christianity. The first pagan intellectual to give Christianity more than a moment's thought was the famous physician Galen, who lived in the late 2nd and early 3rd centuries. For most of his career, Galen resided in Rome, and it is there that he encountered Christians. Unlike previous pagan authors, Galen did not treat the Christians as a nefarious sect, but accorded them the status of a philosophical school. His major criticism of Christians, as well as Jews, was their appeal to faith instead of using reason to justify their beliefs. This was a criticism Galen also held towards the various philosophical schools of his day. Galen himself belonged to no school, and he examined every group's claims with the same critical attitude. Galen's criticism of Christians and Jews, that they appealed to faith instead of reason, may in part be based on the fact that many 2nd century Christians felt uncomfortable expressing their faith in Greek philosophical terms. Of course, the apologists had taken the opposite approach and paved the way for the Christianization of Greek ideas. On the other hand, many rank-and-file believers were more interested in appeals to emotion and faith than critical reasoning. Therefore, it seems obvious that the Christians Galen encountered were not the students of Justin Martyr, but probably believers of the lower class and not educated. The relationship between Greek philosophy and the Christian religion is a complex one we shall see play out across our story. So why did Galen give Christians the honorable status of a philosophical school instead of being a nefarious sect? It was because Galen saw how the Christians led virtuous and moral lives, a trait highly important for philosophical schools in the Greek world. A real philosopher is a virtuous and pious man. Galen did, however, have one particularly significant criticism of Judeo-Christian theology, the doctrine of creation ex nihilo, or creation out of nothing. Instead of the Platonic God who created the universe out of pre-existing matter, with a clear reasoning behind the decision and awareness of the consequences, the God of Moses in Genesis appeared to have simply created the world as an act of sheer will, arbitrary and without a clear reason. Such criticism illustrates some of the fundamental differences between biblical theology and Greek philosophy. While Galen was the first pagan thinker to give more than a passing glance to Christianity, the honor of the first true pagan critic belongs indisputably to Celsus. Sometime in the 170s AD, Celsus, an eclectic Greek philosopher, wrote a book called True Doctrine, the first in-depth pagan attack on the church. Little can be known about Celsus, but from the substantial fragments of his work that survive, we can gather that he was a conservative intellectual. Wilkin, 94. Unlike, say, the satirist Lucian, who poked fun at Christians in his work, Celsus was not a 2nd century Voltaire. Rather, he was deeply sincere in his criticisms of Christianity, and strongly believed that the new religion was a matter of serious concern for the Greco-Roman world. Celsus had first-hand knowledge of Christians, both Catholic and heretical. Celsus jived at the way Christians honored the cross as the tree of life. Celsus suggested that if Jesus was pushed off a cliff, or hung, or stoned, then Christians would venerate a cliff of life, or a rope of life, or a rock of life. Celsus also balked at the way he had seen Christians evangelize. He relates how Christians would visit people of the lower class, women, and children, and convince them that their doctrine was the only truth, and anything their fathers, or husbands, or teachers had to offer was inferior or false. Like Galen, Celsus loathed how many Christians asked for blind faith and did not offer any reasonable arguments to support their theology. For Celsus, Christians were gullible, credulous, superstitious, and even arrogant. They taught the world was doomed to a fiery judgment while only being concerned about their personal salvation. At least this was Celsus's impression, and it no doubt characterized many Christians of his day. Celsus attacked the person of Jesus Christ himself. In this, he imitates the rabbis of his day. He rehashed the slander that the Virgin Mary had had an affair with a Roman soldier named Pantera, and that the tale of Jesus' miraculous conception and birth was invented to hide her adultery. He also promoted the idea that Jesus was a magician trained in the sorcery of Egypt. Magic was a criminal offense in the Roman Empire. Apuleius, the author of The Golden Ass, was once brought to trial on charges of magic. Celsus, again imitating Jewish critics of Jesus, alleged that Jesus' miracles in the Gospels, if they even happened, were the work of demons, specifically using demonic incantations to perform magic. Christians invoke the name of Jesus when performing exorcisms, which Celsus also naturally identified as magic. He also argued that Jesus' miracles were nothing special or new. Greek heroes had already done acts like that, and yet none of them claimed to be the Son of God. Why was Jesus anything special? Furthermore, while Christianity was a new barbarian cult, what new teaching did it bring that Plato and other philosophers had not already expounded upon and taught better than the Christians? Philosophers had taught and lived similar lives to Jesus, and yet none of them claimed to be divine. Also, were Christians really monotheists? Celsus believed that the worship of Jesus as the Son of God compromised the oneness and uniqueness of the Heavenly Father, high God of all of the universe. Next, the Christian conception of exclusive monotheism was also abhorrent to Celsus. Here his conservatism shows most clearly. All nations had their own gods and ancient traditions. The various traditions of each people were old and venerable, and therefore valid. Yet the one supreme god of Plato and Aristotle was still worshipped through all the other gods of the nations. Why on earth should we believe that every single nation, except Jews and Christians, has it wrong? Why is the God of Abraham the only deity worthy of worship? In this, Celsus was defending the traditional monotheism of Greek philosophy, a henotheism where the high gods stood at the top of a global pantheon. Now, at the very least, the Jews were faithful in this regard. Sure, their monotheism was exclusivistic, but at least they held to their ancient rites and worshipped their own national deity. Celsus keenly recognized the intimate and contentious relationship between Judaism and Christianity, a weak point later pagan critics would exploit as well. Christianity was new, even though it claimed to come from Judaism. The Jews had disowned it, and Christians did not observe the Mosaic Law. In reality, Christianity was a new apostate sect from the old, though somewhat respectable, religion of the Jews. Despite Celsus's dismissal of Christianity as being unoriginal and inferior compared to Greek philosophy, he did notice how Christians had some unique and novel teachings, such as the Incarnation, the Resurrection, and, as already noted, the Christian monotheism, which included the worship of Jesus alongside the Father. Here, another impasse between biblical and Hellenic thought becomes apparent. Greek thought often conceived the body and material world as inferior to, and unworthy of, the divine and spiritual world. In one sense, Christians agreed with this. God was spirit, after all. But on the other hand, God had created the world, and the end goal of Christians was both spiritual and physical salvation in the New Jerusalem. As a result, doctrines such as the incarnation and resurrection were highly offensive to Celsus. You may remember way back when the Apostle Paul visited Athens, the Greek philosophers on the Areopagus were hostile to the resurrection. The fate of the soul after death was not concerned with the body. The frail mortal flesh simply could not be part of the eternal state. Such an idea was revolting to Greek senses. If Celsus was disgusted by the resurrection, you can only imagine how he felt about the doctrine of the incarnation. God, Celsus believed, would never do something so low, so abasing, so unworthy as to descend from the heavens to earth and become human. Such an idea was blasphemous for Celsus. And furthermore, why would God need to do such a thing? Was he not all-powerful and all-knowing? What could he possibly gain from such an undertaking? Surely, if God desired to know human experience, he would go about it another way. Also, how could God abandon his throne in heaven as ruler of the cosmos? Why would the Supreme Being be so concerned about the meager lives of mortal creatures in such a direct and personal way? In summary, the God of the philosophers was a rational being, existing within the laws of reason and nature. The God of the Christians was irrational, and therefore, according to Celsus, not worthy of worship. Here I have offered a meaty sample of Celsus's criticisms. If you want to read it all for yourself, there is Henry Chadwick's translation of Origen's Contra Celsum. Origen is a 3rd-century Christian whom we will discuss in the future. About 70 years after Celsus wrote True Doctrine, Origen wrote a detailed refutation of his work, and in so doing, excerpted vast sums of Celsus's book, thus preserving what most likely otherwise would have been lost or suppressed. While some pagans began responding intellectually to Christianity, persecution was also occurring. Celsus believed that Christians, being an illegal sect and a threat to the Roman social order, were justly punished in persecution. However, persecution declined slightly at the end of the 2nd century. On March 17th, 180 AD, after a long and difficult reign, Marcus Aurelius died, and the imperial mantle was passed to his infamous son, Commodus. For those of you who listen to the history of Rome, you are aware that Commodus's ascension marks the end of Rome's golden age and the beginning of the empire's long decline. For the classical world, the death of Marcus Aurelius was tragic. But for the church, things were more ambiguous. While Marcus was no doubt one of Rome's best emperors, he was obviously hostile to the church. We have seen how he authorized the Gallic pogrom and criticized Christians directly in his meditations. Persecution also remained a constant threat in his reign, and official policy towards Christianity may have even in fact become worse, becoming more violent. All of this stands in mild contrast to Commodus, who appears to have been somewhat favorable towards Christians. His favorite mistress, Marcia, was either a Christian herself or a Christian sympathizer. We shall see an example of this next episode. One of Commodus's chamberlains, Marcus Aurelius Prosennus, is also thought to have been a Christian. So, for all the awful things Commodus was, depraved, insane, violent, he at least did not share his father's negative attitude towards Christianity. It is for this reason that Eusebius has the unique distinction of being the only ancient historian to judge Commodus favorably. Commodus' disposition should not be taken to mean that Christians enjoyed total peace in his rule. On the contrary, multiple instances of martyrdom are attested to in his reign. As I am sure you are tired of hearing me say, persecution of Christians prior to the 3rd century came not from the emperors, but local governors and popular outrage. The first attested martyrdoms during the reign of Commodus were precisely the work of the local governor. The settings of these martyrdoms is the birthplace of Western Christianity, Africa. Yes, you heard that right. The birthplace of Western Christianity, and by Western I mean Latin-speaking as opposed to Greek-speaking, is Africa. Now, I plan to introduce Africa and the city of Carthage proper in episode 20, so I won't spend too much time in the background here. Suffice it to say that Christianity had spread to what is now modern-day Tunisia and the surrounding area by 180 AD. How long had Christianity existed in North Africa up to this point? We do not know. I also need to clarify how I am using the term Africa. Today, the term designates one of the 7 continents of the world, but that is not how I am going to use the word. Instead, when I use the term Africa, I will be referring to the area known in antiquity as Africa, the coastal region north of the Sahara Desert and west of Egypt. In this, I am using the term Africa similar to the term Asia, not denoting an entire continent, but the region of that name as known to the Romans. Today, this area contains the modern nations of Libya, Tunisia, and Algeria. So when I refer to African Christians, I am referring to Romano, Berber, slash Moorish, and Punic Christians, native to the area around ancient Carthage. By doing this, I hope to avoid confusion between that group of Christians and all the other group of ancient Christians we today would identify as African, including Copts, Nubians, and Ethiopians. To be clear, I'm not in any way implying that Copts, Nubians, and Ethiopians are not African in the contemporary sense of that identity. I'm simply using the word African in this more restricted and ancient sense for the purpose of clarity. So, with that out of the way, Roman Africa is the birthplace of Latin Christianity. Perhaps most of you would have supposed that Rome, or even Gaul, would be the land from which the Latin Christian West sprung. But, as we have seen, the Roman and Gallic churches were composed of large Greek-speaking immigrants from places like Asia. The first man to bring persecution against the African church was Vigilius Saturninus, proconsul of Africa in 180 AD. On July 4th, a few weeks after Commodus' ascension, Saturninus executed 4 Berber Christians from the locale of Mardara, which is located in the region of Numidia, that is, the region west of Carthage and today the northmost area of Algeria. The names of these 4 Numidian Christians have been preserved: Namphanio, Migan, Lucitas, and Sanae. Unfortunately, the record of their trial and execution has not been preserved, and it is only from a mention in a letter by Augustine of Hippo that we know of the first African martyrs. The second batch of martyrs under Saturninus, though, have had their acts preserved. These were a group of 12 martyrs from the town of Scilium near Carthage. On July 17th, shortly after the martyrs of Mardara gave their lives, the proconsul brought 12 Christians into the Senate House of Carthage. Their names were Sparatus, who acted as the spokesman, Narzullus, Satinus, Veturius, Felix, Aquilinus, Leontantius, Januaria, Generosa, Donata, Secunda, and Vestia. The proconsul comes off from the account as being a very devout, defensive pagan, angered by the critical attitude Christians held towards Roman religion. Saturninus pressed the group to swear by the divine genius of Caesar, but to no avail. He even offered the Christians a period of 30 days to reconsider and save their earthly lives. But Sparatus and his brothers and sisters held fast, and Sparatus even offered to instruct the proconsul in Christian teaching. But Saturninus would not let them speak ill of the Roman gods. Sparatus defended their innocence of any real crimes against the state, but also affirmed that they recognized no king but God himself. So when at last all 12 of them refused to give in, Saturninus had them all beheaded. The Acts of the Scylitian Martyrs is a fascinating little gem from the early church. For one, it is a reliable court transcript of the event. Second, it is the first Latin Christian text we possess. And three, it informs us that a Latin Bible already existed by 180 AD. Unfortunately, we do not know who first translated the scriptures or when. As had happened before, Asia briefly experienced a scene of martyrdoms under the proconsul Aureus Antoninus in 185 AD, but after some executions, the proconsul dismissed the rest of the assembled Christians as suicidal, and the local persecution subsided. The last instance of martyrdom recorded in Commodus's reign is that of a man named Apollonius in the city of Rome under the Praetorian prefect, Sextus Tigidius Perennis. You may remember the ambitious and shrewd Perennis from the History of Rome, episode 96. Around 185 AD, a Roman Christian of some social stature, possibly even a senator, was brought before the Praetorian prefect to recant his Christian beliefs, swear by Emperor Commodus, and sacrifice. Perennis appears to have been reluctant to press Apollonius, even giving him a day to reconsider. Apollonius, for his part, gave a stirring and elegant defense of the Christian faith to the assembly. In the end, though, Apollonius suffered the same death of all Christians who refused to obey the Roman magistrates. The combined assault of both persecution and intellectual criticism was met, of course, by the apologists. Since episode 9, we have seen how one of the major features of second century Christianity was the Greek apologists, authors who wrote to a hostile Greco-Roman world in an attempt to counter pagan slanders and establish Christianity as a respectable religion. First, we had Quadratus and Aristides of Athens writing to Emperor Hadrian, then we had Justin Martyr writing to Antoninus, and next, Marcus Aurelius had four apologists write to him, Apollinaris of Hierapolis, Melito of Sardis, Athenagoras of Athens, and one of Justin's students, Miltiades. Despite their valiant efforts, though, imperial policy remained either the same or became even worse. Theophilus, bishop of Antioch, the last of these authors, stands out from the rest because his apology was addressed not to the Roman emperor, but a pagan acquaintance named Autolycus. In this, Theophilus anticipated 3rd century authors who correctly gauged that local opinions, rather than those of the emperors, were far more pertinent for the Christian community. On another note, Theophilus is the first Christian author to use the word Trinitas to describe the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. When we reach the end of the 3rd century, Theophilus's contribution to Christian theology will be examined in more detail. For the moment, Theophilus of Antioch brings us to the close of the classic age of Christian apologetics. Next episode, we will turn our attention back to Gaul and examine the life, career, and thought of the greatest Christian author of the 2nd century, Irenaeus, Bishop of Lyons. Well, thank you again for listening. Please comment, review, and subscribe. If you have questions or thoughts about the show, you can email me at historyoftheearlychurch@gmail.com. Be sure to visit the Facebook page, facebook.com/earlychurchpodcast. And be sure to visit the website, historyoftheearlychurch.wordpress.com.